So we're midway through this chapter, the release from subjection to the body, chapter 7, in the Yoga of Integral Knowledge. Sri Aurobindo is going to speak now about how the awakened consciousness imposes its will on the various powers of nature. Purusha becomes sovereign to not merely witness, sakshi, but also anamanta, imposing its will on prakriti. So he begins this paragraph. This side of the method belongs properly to the yoga of self-perfection. But it is as well to speak briefly of these things here, both because we thereby lay a basis for what we shall have to say of self-perfection, which is a part of the integral yoga, and because we have to correct the false notions popularized by materialistic science. Well, this yoga of self-perfection he would get to in the latter stages of his essays on the synthesis. Never bringing it to completion, as we've noted before, probably a third of what he had to say on the subject got committed to paper. More was to come. He was giving explication in the yoga of self-perfection to what his own practice was in more general terms. We have the notes on that and what's been published in two volumes in the collected works on Sri Aurobindo as Record of Yoga, a series of notebooks that he kept with different titles, but primarily that, from roughly 1910 all the way until he quit writing about these things around 1927. So the yoga of self-perfection would bring to point all the streams of possible yogic practice towards the perfection of the self writ large. So he wants to establish that here in a few sentences we'll touch upon these items, but also to lay waste to those who think of science as being of only one kind. Science means knowledge, and so it's an inquiry into the truth of things, whether they're material, vital, mental, whether they go beyond the realm of the known nature into what he would call supernature, escape the limits of prakriti for para-prakriti, because it is not possible for Sri Aurobindo to see division in reality. For him, reality is always one, but it is an inclusive one, not an exclusive reality, like is seen by Shankara, who says, you imagine you see a universe, it's not really there. For Sri Aurobindo, the self is part of this larger world. But if you have identified with the extremities, with the outermost skin of the universe, then you haven't realized its conscious origins. You have forgotten your connection to yourself. And so it is incumbent upon the seeker to get to the source of what is the knower before attempting to have knowledge. Once you know who you are by identity, then your knowledge will be of a different mint. So back to Sri Aurobindo's paragraph here. According to this science, the normal mental and physical states and the relations between mind and body actually established by our past evolution are the right, natural, and healthy conditions. And anything other, anything opposite to them, is either morbid and wrong or a hallucination, self-deception, and insanity. This would mean to say your given nature is what it is, and you shall never change. So just accept what you are. Well, we haven't seen that work very well. Needless to say, he writes, this conservative principle is entirely ignored by science itself when it so diligently and successfully improves on the normal operations of physical nature for the greater mastery of nature by man. Suffice it to say here, once for all, that a change of mental and physical state and of relations between the mind and body, which increases the purity and freedom of the being, brings a clear joy and peace and multiplies the power of the mind over itself and over the physical functions, brings about, in a word, man's greater mastery of his own nature, is obviously not morbid and cannot be considered a hallucination or self-deception, since its effects are patent and positive. In fact, it is simply a willed advance of nature in her evolution of the individual, an evolution which she will carry out in any case, but in which she chooses to utilize the human will as her chief agent, because her essential aim is to lead the Purusha to conscious mastery over herself. This is a true Purna Advaita, a full non-dualism, because Purusha is not seen as being different from Prakriti. Prakriti is indeed trying to awaken the Purusha from within. This is a point that is made in some elements of Sankhyan thinking. You know, all of this terminology of Purusha, Prakriti, and the various tattvas of nature stem from this originating philosophy in India. There is the point made there that Prakriti is always trying to encourage Purusha to release itself from subjection, has found this downward path, establishing a cosmic tree, if you will, which arrives in the brute realities of external nature, but offers that same ladder to climb back up to attain self-transcendence. So nature herself is driving us forward. So we don't rest at the bottom, but we actually see a progression of creatures climbing towards full self-awareness. So from exteriorized being, eventually to become aware of oneself and become an I-maker, an ahankara appears, a manas, a buddhi, ultimately an awakening to Purusha behind. So the other analogy you could find in Indian philosophy, which is more readily comparable to Sri Aurobindo, is of course the Trika philosophy of Kashmir, starting with the oldest of the agamas and the tantric writings, 500, 600 on, till you get to Abhinavagupta, and that Trika in which knowledge, jnana, is the same as kriya, action. Both are aspects of Chaitanya, the supreme consciousness, which is not different from nature. Ishvara is Ishwari. Consciousness plays in nature. Consciousness is not simply sheer awareness, but this conscious being, Chaitanya, is also in a vibratory dance, completely in the universe, concealing itself, embedding itself in every particle of manifestation, but remains the all-including consciousness beyond, never loses its transcendence in becoming universal and in establishing itself inside the individual as its core reality. So we read a passage like this from Sri Aurobindo and realize that this echoes through Indian history going back centuries and centuries. He continues, "This being said, we must add that in the movement of the path of knowledge, perfection of the mind and body are no consideration at all, or only secondary considerations." He's talking about the limited goals of Jnana Yoga as we have traditionally known it in Advaita Vedanta. "The one thing necessary is to rise out of nature to the self by either the most swift or the most thorough and effective method possible. And the method we are describing, though not the swiftest, is the most thoroughgoing in its effectivity. If we're looking for Parusha Jnana, the knowledge of the person, Sri Aurobindo is going to assert that this quick exit out the world to an absolute beyond time and space gives you only part of the nature of the divine. Yes, the essential part. But you've ignored everything that the divine has become here. Because remember, it's both at once. So it is more thoroughgoing in that it will arrive at an inclusive, comprehensive presentation of knowledge to the growing self. And here, there arises the question of physical action or inaction. Remember, Sri Aurobindo will not plump towards inaction. He will not rest apart from the world, but insists on action, indeed in his life, as he does in his theories. Knowledge and power together form the mastery which the self seeks to impose upon its nature. It is ordinarily considered that the yogin should draw away from action as much as possible, and especially that too much action is a hindrance because it draws off the energies outward. To a certain extent, that is true. And we must note farther that when the mental purusha, manomaya purusha, takes up the attitude of mere witness and observer, a tendency to silence, solitude, physical calm, and bodily inaction grows upon the being. So long as this is not associated with inertia, incapacity, or unwillingness to act, in a word, with the growth of the tamasic quality, all this is to the good. The power to do nothing, which is quite different from indolence, incapacity, or aversion to action and attachment to inaction, is a great power and a great mastery. Let's pause in the sentence to note that Sri Aurobindo, in his conversations with his disciples gathered around him after his accident in late 1938, heard him recount the episode when a Maratha gentleman visited him with a group of people back in the 20s when he was still taking visitors, and asked him what he was doing these days. Somebody in the party asked what he was doing. He said, "Nothing." To which one of the visitors said, "To do nothing is a great thing." So let's start this again. The power to do nothing, which is quite different, and he's writing this when, 1916, to do nothing, which is quite different from indolence, incapacity, or aversion to action and attachment to inaction, that distinction in the Gita, is a great power and a great mastery. The power to rest absolutely from action is as necessary for the Jnana Yogin as the power to cease absolutely from thought, as the power to remain indefinitely in sheer solitude and silence, and as the power of immovable calm. So to retire intentionally within the absolute self, there, without determination, without motivation in the mind, without impulse and vitality, without identification to the body, must be one of the powers of the attained yogi. Whoever is not willing to embrace these states is not yet fit for the path that leads towards the highest knowledge. Whoever is unable to draw towards them is as yet unfit for its acquisition. The power must be there to say no to everything. Shiva must be able to sit in the immense and infinite gulfs of his own consciousness. In absolute silence sleeps an absolute power. But one must have the capacity to become the silence. He continues, at the same time, it must be added that the power is enough. The abstention from all physical action is not indispensable. The aversion to action, mental or corporeal, is not desirable. Remember the distinction between tyaga and sannyasa. Tyaga is the inner detachment. Sannyasa is the outer throwing away, the casting off. The seeker of the integral state of knowledge must be free from attachment to action and equally free from attachment to inaction. Back to the Gita. Again, and also you can read for a fuller description of what it is to be able to act in conscious adherence to what is the will of the Purusha, what is the will of the Shakti. You have no farther to go than the fifth chapter of the book, The Mother, the closing paragraph. Especially must any tendency to mere inertia of mind or vitality or body be surmounted. And if that habit is found growing on the nature, the will of the Purusha must be used to dismiss it. Inertia means to keep the current course, whether you're sitting solidly or moving incessantly. Either way is inertia. Remember Newton. Eventually, a state arrives when the life and the body perform as mere instruments of the will of the Purusha in the mind without any strain or attachment, without their putting themselves into the action with that inferior, eager, and often feverish energy, which is the nature of their ordinary working. They come to work as forces of nature work, without the fret and toil and reaction characteristic of life in the body when it is not yet master of the physical. When we attain to this perfection, then action and inaction become immaterial, since neither interferes with the freedom of the soul or draws it away from its urge towards the self or its poise in the self. So this is the state of siddhi. When the siddha, the one who achieves this perfection, is always in the self, whether knowing and being, or whether acting and demonstrating, displaying, revealing. But this state of perfection arrives later in the yoga. Until then, the law of moderation laid down by the Gita is best for us. Too much mental or physical action, then, is not good, since excess draws away too much energy and reacts unfavorably upon the spiritual condition. Too little also is not good, since defect leads to a habit of inaction and even to an incapacity which has afterwards to be surmounted with difficulty. So this is what happens to us. This is the great failure of sannyasa, is that if we divorce ourselves from the world to live in the purity of the self, when we have to come back, when the divine will compels us to return to the world scene, then we have lost all possibility of perfect action. We have no strength. We have no skills. Yoga is skill in work, says the Gita. It is self-knowledge, but one must be master of the scene. You cannot withdraw. He finishes the paragraph by saying, still, periods of absolute calm, solitude, and cessation from works are highly desirable and should be secured as often as possible for that recession of the soul into itself, which is indispensable to knowledge, to secure identity of the self. Yes. Later, when with the mother he begins the Sri Aurobindo ashram, and year after year rolls by, and people want to quit their work, their service, because that's what we call work in the ashram, is service. We're serving the divine. We shouldn't be working for ourselves. We're not trying to get our next plate of dal and rice. We're trying to offer all of our work, even the eating of that dal and rice, to the divine. But people would say, it's time for me to meditate. And Sri Aurobindo would write an encouraging letter. Yes, a moment of meditation is good. Restore yourself to the self, but then come back and work more. We have to remain engaged. And then he had to be a little more curt and discuss what it is that falls into desuetude when we too much retire within. When we sit isolated, then the Shakti is waiting for the opportunity, for the auspicious instrument to come back to the scene so that they can be displayed. We can't simply quit and sit solitary, bemused with the infinity of the self. While dealing thus with the body, we have necessarily to deal also with the prana, or life energy. For practical purposes, we have to make a distinction between the life energy as it acts in the body, the physical prana, and the life energy as it acts in support of the mental activities, the psychical prana. An important distinction, because there's the energy, the universal energy that's fixed in driving the enginery of the body. And there's this power that works to impel the mind, to give it energy. So there are separate courses of action which need to become areas of knowledge for the awakening soul power. It must know how prana plugs into the body and how how prana plugs in to the mind. For we lead always a double life, mental and physical, and the same life energy acts differently and assumes a different aspect according as it lends itself to one or the other. I think we should make a clear distinction here too. When he says psychical prana, that prana that's just plugged into the mind, this is not his use of the term psychic when he refers to the inmost spark growing into a conscious soul, evolving life to life, developing towards full personhood. That's not the use of the psychic here that he means. It's restricted to the field of this inner vitality. In the body, It produces those reactions of hunger, thirst, fatigue, health, disease, physical vigor, etc., which are the vital experiences of the physical frame. For the gross body of man is not like the stone or the earth. It is a combination of two sheaths, the vital and the food sheath, and its life is a constant interaction of these two. Goes back to the Taittiriya Upanishad, which depicts the various stages of cosmic existence and personal existence. And so there is an Annamaya Purusha, the physical person, which is a reality, which is our body, and that is the food sheath. But energizing it is a Pranamaya Purusha. And it is the interrelationship between those two that provides the vital life that we have in the body. If we abstracted the Pranamaya Purusha from Annamaya Purusha, it still exists. But it exists, that person exists only on the pranic plane. Still, the life energy and the physical frame are two different things, and in the withdrawal of the mind from the absorbing sense of the body, we become increasingly sensible of the prana and its action in the corporeal instrument and can observe and more control its operations. So when we draw our conscious attention back from identity with both body and life force, we can see how the life force plays. Practically, in drawing back from the body, we draw back from the physical life energy also, even while we distinguish the two and feel the latter nearer to us than the mere physical instrument. The entire conquest of the body comes, in fact, by the conquest of the physical life energy. So this interface leads us to knowledge of this vital power as it applies to the physical, and if we seek the perfection of knowledge, it must extend to the interrelationship of these various elements that constitute what seems to be our outer self. Without it, we can't become master. We won't have conquest. We might have a witnessing knowledge, but unless we learn how to act with it, we won't have siddhi, fulfillment. So we have to back up, see what these various elements are, gain some psychological distance, if you will, from the action of the mind, from the action of vitality, from the action of the body, and see how this vitality supplies energy to the mind, but also energizes the body, and what that play is like. We can understand the principles of existence. And when we become aware of our larger spiritual self, later we can approach the perfection of these instruments by importing a higher consciousness into these known routes, routes, of conveyance inwards and outwards, and achieve mastery. I hope that makes some sense. Along with the attachment to the body and its works, the attachment to life in the body is overcome. For when we feel the physical being to be not ourselves, but only a dress or an instrument, the repulsion to the death of the body, which is so strong and vehement an instinct of the vital man, must necessarily weaken and can be thrown away. Thrown away it must be, and entirely. The fear of death and the aversion to bodily cessation are the stigma left by his animal origin on the human being. That brand must be utterly effaced. As the brand on your skin, that is what seals you to the old version of yourself. So we come to the end of a chapter. This is, of course, an insistence on first the power to distinguish the indwelling consciousness from the members, and in this case, subjection to the body, subtle body, sukshma sharira, gross body, stula sharira. And next, we'll turn to the release from subjection to the heart and the mind in chapter 8, the release from the heart and the mind. We'll start that next time. So, I thought we could read from Book 2, the Book of the Traveler of the Worlds, Canto 4, The Kingdoms of the Little Life. This would begin on page 136. No, let's begin on page 137. But judged not so, his spirit's wakened eye. As shines a solitary witness star that burns apart light's lonely sentinel, in the drift and teeming of a mindless night, a single thinker in an aimless world awaiting some tremendous dawn of God, he saw the purpose in the works of time. Even in that aimlessness, a work was done, pregnant with magic will and change divine. The first writhings of the cosmic serpent force, uncoiled from the mystic ring of matter's trance. It raised its head in the warm air of life. It could not cast off yet night's stiffening sleep, or wear as yet mind's wonder flecks and streaks, put on its jeweled hood the crown of soul, or stand erect in the blaze of spirit's sun. As yet were only seen foulness and force, the secret crawl of consciousness to light, through a fertile slime of lust and battening sense, beneath the body's crust of thickened self, a tardy fervent working in the dark, the turbid yeast of nature's passionate change, ferment of the soul's creation out of mire. A heavenly process donned this gray disguise, a fallen ignorance in its covert night, labored to achieve its dumb, unseemly work, a camouflage of the inconscient's need to release the glory of God in nature's mud. His sight, spiritual in embodying orbs, could pierce through the gray phosphorescent haze and scan the secrets of the shifting flux that animates these mute and solid cells and leads the thought and longing of the flesh and the keen lust and hunger of its will. This too he tracked along its hidden stream and traced its acts to a miraculous fount. A mystic presence none can probe nor rule, creator of this game of ray and shade, in this sweet and bitter paradoxical life, asks from the body the soul's intimacies, and by the swift vibration of a nerve, links its mechanic throbs to light and love. It summons the spirit's sleeping memories up from subconscient depths beneath time's foam. Oblivious of their flame of happy truth, arriving with heavy eyes that hardly see, they come disguised as feelings and desires, like weeds upon the surface float a while and rise and sink on a somnambulous tide. Impure, degraded though her motions are. Always a heaven truth broods in life's deeps. In her obscurest members burns that fire. A touch of God's rapture in creation's acts, a lost remembrance of felicity, lurks still in the dumb roots of death and birth. The world's senseless beauty mirrors God's delight. That rapture smile is secret everywhere. It flows in the wind's breath, in the tree's sap. Its hued magnificence blooms in leaves and flowers. When life broke through its half drowse in the plant that feels and suffers but cannot move or cry, in beast and in winged bird and thinking man, it made of the heart's rhythm its music's beat. It forced the unconscious tissues to awake and ask for happiness and earn the pang and thrill with pleasure and laughter of brief delight and quiver with pain and crave for ecstasy. Imperative, voiceless, ill understood, too far from light, too close to being's core, born strangely in time from the eternal bliss. It presses on heart's core and vibrant nerve. Its sharp self-seeking tears our consciousness. Our pain and pleasure have that sting for cause. Instinct with it, but blind to its true joy, the soul's desire leaps out towards passing things. All nature's longing drive, none can resist, comes surging through the blood and quickened sense. An ecstasy of the infinite is her cause. Namaste. Jai Ma.